Brought to you by the Small Business Payments Alliance. According to a new survey, an overwhelming majority of small business owners oppose additional government regulations on the electronic payment system, as called for in the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. Don't let Durbin-Marshall pile new mandates on Main Street small businesses. Learn more at smallbusinesspaymentsalliance.com.
The State of the Union is not only the biggest night of the year for the president, it's also a big night for any first lady. Over time, her role at the State of the Union has become institutionalized. The cameras pan to her when she enters the House chamber. She sits high in the audience, surrounded by special guests who the president's team has carefully selected to highlight various political messages. And she inevitably gets a heartfelt shout-out from the president, followed by something rare at a State of the Union these days, a bipartisan standing ovation. The First Lady's ceremonial role at the speech is emblematic of their role in America. You see them a lot, but you don't hear from them all that much. Which is too bad, because the First Lady is often one of the most influential, and therefore one of the most powerful people in the White House. Jill Biden is no exception.
Joe Biden's inner circle is as much Jill's domain as it is his. So she's really a gatekeeper for the people who are closest to him, even though she's not in the West Wing. She's not stationed there or anything, holding open the door to the Oval. But she definitely knows everything that's going on.
New York Times reporter Katie Rogers has been studying Jill Biden, Melania Trump, and their recent predecessors for years. And her new book is American Woman: The Transformation of the Modern First Lady from Hillary Clinton to Jill Biden. In our conversation, we covered everything from their roles in staffing, campaigning, and policy decisions, to Melania and Donald's prenup, to whether or not Jill has ever forgiven Kamala Harris for what she said about Joe in 2020. And Katie opened up about the time her editors at the New York Times sent her to Arkansas and forced her to report a story about the Bidens that she didn't want to cover, and how it ended up forcing Jill and Joe to confront an uncomfortable truth about their family. Don't forget to stick around to the end when Katie answers a question from last week's guest. I'm Ryan Lizza, and this is Playbook Deep Dive. Let's talk about Jill Biden in office and what we've now learned about her in these 3+ years. I mean, the first thing that comes through is this seems to be a thing with first ladies and frankly with most couples that are, you know, are in healthy, strong relationships. But there's a strong element of Jill the enforcer.
Yep, for sure.
And a couple of interesting examples of that. Maybe start with Kamala.
Yeah, it's so baked into her. I could go back to the 80s, but like we could start with Kamala Harris, sure. So Harris is, you know, during one of the Democratic primary debates, essentially equates Biden's lack of support for integrating schools. She basically calls him a segregationist during a debate. It becomes a moment in which Harris receives a bump in the polls. It's very temporary. And in exchange for that slight bump she gets, she earns a very visceral reaction from Jill Biden, who essentially says, you know, go fuck yourself. Do you say that on here?
We can. Yeah. I encourage it because then we get a very classy, explicit rating on Apple.
Oh, that's cool. I'm on the First Ladies episode. Look at that. So anyway, this earns, you know, Jill Biden's is very angry about this. There was one moment in 2022 where Jill Biden goes to a fundraiser in the city of San Francisco, which is Kamala Harris's home turf, and is hearing from donors about how much they hope Kamala Harris is serving the Bidens and how proud they are of her. We just hope she represents us well, meaning, you know, San Francisco. And Jill Biden, who is a very classically trained fundraising political spouse, doesn't say anything, takes a beat to the point where it's awkward and says, but what about Ketanji? Steering the conversation away from a very fulsome compliment of the vice president toward her husband's pick for Supreme Court. And if you ask people who know her, that surprises nobody. One person said, you know, she's Italian. It's about loyalty is exactly how they just explained that whole thing to me. And a couple other examples, maybe a prime one is Ron Klain, who was Biden's first chief of staff, obviously, in a long time, fixture of Biden world. When he decamped to work on Hillary Clinton's campaign, that was seen as an ultimate sort of disloyal move. And several people actually told me that it took a lot of diplomacy to, you know, get Jill to the point that she was supportive of this. And I don't think from my reporting that she would ultimately have the power to stop someone like Klain coming on. But I also think she wouldn't do that because at points throughout their history together, and Harris is actually an example, she understands that what these people can bring will help her husband win. So whatever personal animosity she feels for them, or felt, she would say, you know, that pales in comparison to the potential she saw in them helping her husband win. And that's like a key thing to understand about her and Biden, actually, is how competitive they are.
Absolutely, yeah. And it makes me wonder, your narrative about her somewhat fraught relationship with Kamala Harris does make me wonder how much lingering friction contributes to Harris's difficulties in the Biden White House, and sort of how much it might be preventing her from being a full partner. I mean, I know that's right. Just speculation.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing I would just say to that is Joe Biden's inner circle is as much Jill's domain as it is his. So she's really a gatekeeper for the people who are closest to him, even though she's not in the West Wing. She's not stationed there or anything, you know, holding open the door to the Oval. But right. she definitely knows everything that's going on. She has several aides who have been with Biden, the Bidens, I guess I should say, for years, if not decades. They understand how she wants things to be run. They understand that loyalty is super, super paramount. And if it's violated, it's really hard to get that back with both Bidens and especially Jill. That being said, you know, what's interesting is Joe Biden has had the VP role and had it for 8 years and understands how hard it can be. Whatever his wife or his advisors might still feel about the campaign, it's interesting that he has kept Harris at a distance compared to others in his orbit.
Speaking of gatekeeping and the East Wing and Jill's staff, take us inside that a little bit. And there's a character who you flesh out that I think our listeners would find interesting. Mm-hmm. And that is Anthony Bernal, who I think you quote Jill as saying is her work marriage is to Anthony. Tell us a little bit about what it's like inside the East Wing and what role Anthony has.
Yeah, so Anthony first came to the Bidens on the 2008 campaign as part of Jill Biden's staff, and quickly sort of established himself as an ear for her when, you know, the Biden camp, you know, sort of struggled against the Obama machine and struggled to adjust during that campaign because there were adjustments that needed to be made for Joe Biden, who is so used to being the North Star of his operation and campaign. So starting there, traveling forward to 2015 when Beau Biden dies of brain cancer, part of that relationship with Anthony Bernal and the Bidens is absolutely solidified because of how he was able to keep their privacy intact. He's incredibly loyal. Somebody told me that he would walk in front of a speeding train for her. And all of that manifests into an East Wing that has actually no chief of staff. Jill Biden's chief of staff
still
left,
huh?
Like 2 years ago, I think. And ever since then, it's a chief of staffless East Wing, which is very unusual. Anthony Bernal is the most powerful person in that East Wing by far, because he has dominion over everything that happens in it, from trip scheduling to speeches to messaging. And this is a person whose background is in scheduling in advance. So he's got control over all sorts of different levers that the First Lady has, but also by extension, he's in senior calls every day. He helped plan the president's trip to Ukraine because the First Lady had gone there first, obviously. Another interesting thing is President Biden went to Brownsville last week to the border. Jill Biden made that trip during the campaign, and that was something that had already been scouted and blueprinted by Bernal. So what is interesting is how he has sort of made blueprints for how these trips go, how the president looks when we see him, not just the First Lady. So he's a very interesting figure in the sense that he has a lot of control in the East Wing, certainly, and a lot of control in the West Wing. And the other beat to that is he is known to sort of be very overbearing. He can be aggressive and direct with aides, specifically less experienced ones. And that has, at times been a source of a lot of tension in the White House.
Another really fascinating stories in this book, Katie, is very sensitive reporting around Hunter Biden and London Roberts's child, Navy Joan Roberts. This was a blockbuster story. And I wonder if you could just tell us how it came about, whether you were apprehensive at all about, digging into this. And the fallout from it.
Yeah, so I really didn't want to do it. it was
who made you do it?
People way above my pay grade, as we like to say. People, in New York, and people in the highest ranks of Washington assigned it, and it was
funny.
You were
just following orders.
Well, I was really trying not to for a while, and we had several meetings about it. I have a daughter. You've met her. She plays hard to get with you, but she likes you a lot. But anyway, I have a daughter, and I kept thinking about how, the way I perceived the story was that they wanted me to write about a little girl whose family didn't want her. And I just really was not, journalistically, I couldn't wrap my head around that assignment. And
yeah.
I just kept saying no, and they kept sort of sitting me down. And eventually I had a conversation with our bureau chief, a woman named Elizabeth Buehmiller, who brought me to the bureau. And I trust her a lot, because this is the kind of story that to me is like, if I do this badly, it's my last one. Like, I don't want to, pursue a story that I can't keep control of, so she kind of sat me down and said, you can do the story because it's about two families. One of them is powerful and one of them is not powerful. And this is a story about what it means to be a Biden. And that gave me the grounding, I think, and the journalistic sort of curiosity that I needed to pursue, because I didn't want to write about a child support dispute and a little girl who, I just really... So I went down to Arkansas and made contact with the family and learned more about the little girl. And the more I learned, the more I realized how loved she was and innocent she was. And she was literally above this toxic, horrible, politicized mess, So when I sat down to write the story, I'm proudest of the lead, where I kind of made her the top, you see a little blonde girl in the story with sun in her hair and riding four-wheelers and playing with her cousins. And then it backs into the the sort of ugliness that adults in her life are engaged in. Yeah, it was, I think it ended up being an important story because it led to the president and the first lady acknowledging a granddaughter that they hadn't ever acknowledged publicly before. Now they say they have 7 grandkids and not 6. And, you know, the Hunter Biden is participating in or upholding his end of the agreement. I'm proud of how the story turned out. At some point it becomes a private matter again, but so that's kind of how I had to get my head around it.
Well, it was an excellent story, and you dealt with it with an incredible amount of sensitivity.
Thanks.
And it did something rare in political journalism, which is you held up a mirror to the people who you identified just now as the powerful players in the saga, and sort of forced them to confront how they were dealing with this, and that they couldn't really defend it and weren't proud of it, which is really rare in our business, because most of the time you write something that's critical and it's just attack it and, you know,
discredit it.
And mm-hmm. they did the opposite. They went to People Magazine, and, you know, I know you had a bit of an assist from Maureen Dowd, who wrote a column about it.
Yeah.
And it changed, it completely changed the way that the Biden family talks publicly about their granddaughter. So,
yeah. And Maureen does deserve credit. You know, she was able to speak directly to him. And from my reporting, I know he read that. And, you know, I think that having the journalistic base is super important before a column like that, but she was able to sort of speak directly to the president on that one.
He's still a voracious reader of, I think, what Evan Osnos likes to call in his one of his Biden pieces, the classics. You know, the classics, Tom Friedman and Maureen and the other great opinion columnists
it's
at the
true.
Times. A good chunk of the book is about the history of first ladies and the changes in that role. Who was the first lady that you researched that maybe was the most surprising to you, or that you learned something new and interesting about that you just didn't expect?
Growing up during the Clinton and Bush years, you know, I was little during the Clintons, but, you know, high school, college during Bush, and revisiting Laura Bush was actually the most interesting for me because, you know, I grew up at a time where the older brothers of my friends were literally going to war. That started happening when I was in high school.
Where'd you grow up, Katie?
Elkhart, Indiana. I'm actually here right now. I'm home for the day to talk at a college. But so that was something that was part of my adolescence, part of my young adulthood, and I just was not paying attention to the first lady for a lot of reasons. I was paying close attention to what was happening in our country and what the decisions the president was making. And I knew who Laura Bush was, but I didn't know anything about her. So going back and sort of revisiting her time was super fascinating to me. She launched the National Book Festival 3 days before 9/11 happened. The National Book Festival was going to be her thing. That was it. You know, I'm a librarian. I'm going to talk about literacy. I'm going to support No Child Left Behind. And that's pretty much it. And then she becomes a wartime first lady overnight and has to assume the president's regular radio address talking about the war and talking about the plight of Afghan women and girls. And Hillary Clinton's advisors told me, you know, there's no way on God's green earth that she could have done that. You know, she couldn't have. She was divisive and ambitious, and the country sort of parts of the country revolted against that. And the point about Laura that people made to me was that, you know, she was able to do that because of how forward looking Hillary Clinton was. And you can argue against that, but there's some element of truth to that, where Laura Bush was able to blaze a trail and sort of take over a very staid, traditional avenue for the president because of what was going on around her at the time.
Do you think it was easier for Republican first ladies to have a role like that because they weren't as out there on the policy realm? So it sort of, it didn't play to type. You know, one of the interesting things in reading the book is the difference between the way that Barbara Bush and Hillary Clinton were treated. The big sort of scandal, if you can call it that.
I suppose Republican women have had it easier, but really they haven't in their own way, because the knee-jerk reaction to them is they're housewives and helpmates. And, you know, if you know anything about Barbara Bush, you know, her primary role was to, you know, be a wife and a mother, but she was an advisor and a confidant and had immense influence within her family. And in that White House, people knew not to cross her. She was known to have very sharp political instincts and an even sharper sense of humor. She was a powerful woman. And I think, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, I mean, Hillary Clinton was expected to walk this very fine line of being a wife and a supporter, but not disparaging women by talking about her own career. And, you know, when Hillary Clinton was introducing herself to the country, she kind of, you know, made a few missteps that when she's, I'm not going to stay at home and bake cookies, I want to work. And the reaction to her was a lot sharper in another way. But it all goes back to this idea that women are expected to be one thing or the other, and they must not emerge from those boxes. And Republicans and Democrats both deal with different versions of that same gendered expectation.
You know, now that we're talking this through, one thing that strikes me is that the kind of dominant criticism of these first ladies, as you tell these stories, it's usually the criticism from their political opponents that sort of becomes the one we remember. Right? With Hillary Clinton, it was from the right. With Melania, certainly, it was the criticism from the left, where the first lady's own party tends to be sort of quiet and just sort of respects who they are.
Or completely ignores them. I mean,
they don't become a lightning rod for their own party.
Yeah. And what's interesting about Melania, remember when everybody thought she was a secret resistance figure?
That's what I want to talk to you. I want to talk to you about that, because that's the thread that runs through your material on her. And you report this out. You answer this question. What are your conclusions about that?
She's not a secret resistance figure. But that's all to say, I think there was this time for maybe the first year, and maybe that's because she wasn't actually in Washington yet. She was still getting her son ready to move down and working out some, you know, marriage-related agreements back home before she moved down to Washington.
Brought to you by the Small Business Payments Alliance. According to a new survey, an overwhelming majority of small business owners oppose additional government regulations on the electronic payment system, as called for in the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. Don't let Durbin-Marshall pile new mandates on Main Street small businesses. Learn more at smallbusinesspaymentsalliance.com.
The reporting about Melania and Donald negotiating the legal agreement between them early in the presidency, what did you discover about that?
So Mary Jordan, she's a journalist for The Washington Post, first reported this in her book on Melania Trump, which is that part of the delay in Melania Trump coming to Washington was she was reorganizing her pre- and post-nuptial agreements with Donald Trump, which her office denied at the time. I did some reporting for my book, and years had passed, and people had left the Trump administration and were willing to speak on the record about what they knew and what they had seen. And Stephanie Grisham, who is Melania Trump's former communications director, former White House press secretary, she's written sort of a tell-all about her time. But she talked to me separately for this and said much of her time was indeed focused. And throughout her time in the White House, it was focused on postnuptial agreements and money she had in the bank. Melania Trump's office didn't outright deny this. They just said to me, she's a businesswoman and has her own business interests to uphold. And that was in the context of me asking about, you know, did she spend a lot of time in the White House meeting with her lawyers? Yes, she did. So that's sort of what I know. So I think there was just a lot of expectation or maybe even hope among liberals. And this was like back to your point about the other party not liking a first lady. There was a time where people were almost liking her, it felt like to me, and this is all anecdotal, but there's polling that shows that she was pretty popular at one point. Because
she was a secret member of the resistance.
Yeah, there was this like expectation that she was the reason she was slapping his hand away in public or not moving down was because she had opposition to what he believed. And I think, you know, the reality of it is that, you know, after reporting on her, is she mirrors her husband's grievances and channels them in her own way and is in most cases not a mediating force for him at all. In fact, the opposite is often true, where if, you know, her husband is being attacked, she encourages him to fight back. Charlottesville, she got a lot of credit for in the aftermath of that rally, which ended up in someone's death. You know, she said, let the violence stop, when her husband said both sides have good people. But that, you know, is really an outlier, I think, a very public one. But she is someone who's much more likely to channel her husband's beliefs. And that also is rooted in his birtherism stuff with President Obama. She was on The View talking about how Obama needed to show off his birth certificate because people wanted to know.
And on January 6th, she was not exactly a moderating influence on him, was she?
I don't think she was any sort of influence. I mean, I think as I write in the book, toward the end of her time there, she was in the residence all the time, almost all the time. And when she wasn't, she was summoning a photographer to take photos of the aesthetic changes she had made to the White House, which are culturally relevant. I don't mean to, you know, disparage a first lady's interest in improving the White House complex. But during an unfolding of such violence, and I mean, it was stunning as things unfolded that day, she was asked by Grisham whether she wanted to say anything to encourage an end to violence. And she just flat out said no. And she was busy having photographs of a rug taken that day. So that's what she was up to while Trump was in the dining room off the Oval watching the proceedings.
What's your sense now of her complete lack of a public role in the Trump campaign? And if you had to predict, what do you think it'll be this year?
I mean, you know that it's terrible to predict things, but I'm going to go ahead and do it. Anyway, I think knowing what I know and what my reporting on Melania Trump shows, she likes being first lady. But my reporting does not show that she enjoys campaigning. My reporting does not show that she enjoys defending her husband, as she has been called to do numerous times. And my reporting doesn't show that she has an interest in returning to Washington full time. So I guess taken together, if Trump wins, we could expect a first lady who embraces the role, but possibly because she was such a norm breaking figure, you know, takes her time coming to Washington, goes back and forth. That's seems possible to me. People who know her say that she would absolutely do it over again, but they're less clear on the details of what that would look like. And in terms of being a campaigner, she's somebody who has no interest in doing that. I know Trump has said that she will be out there in the near future, but I don't know. I think I would be surprised to see her out anytime soon on the trail.
Yeah, like maybe seems like she's prepared to do the bare minimum. So how did it change with Jill Biden? She, you know, it's interesting going from Michelle to Melania to Jill.
Yeah, for sure.
Jill's a lot older. She'd been around Washington for a long time, had a lot of experience, was second lady, is that for eight years?
Second lady, yeah.
And, you know, was a little bit more integrated into the Washington community than Michelle was. You know, at least Michelle pretended to hate everyone in D.C. and, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Bidens, even when they were vice president, they would have press parties at the vice president's mansion and were very kind of friendly with the swamp. You know, she'd sort of seen it up close, but right away she had her own challenges. And just tell us the story of sort of the will with which she pressed on the campaign and her own husband in sort of carving out her role as a teacher and how historically unique that was.
Yeah, I think starting with her relationship with Joe Biden is maybe the way to look at that in terms of how much he adores her. He just is obsessed with his wife, I think. And I think they have a real love story. But the second beat of that
I hate to interrupt you, but I just have to drag the one, you know, there's always like a nugget in a book. And this is obviously good for you.
Yeah.
You know, hopefully it led to some sales. But just tell listeners, for those who don't know, this piece of this nugget from the book that sort of went viral and created a ton of news in the rollout. You know what I'm going to ask?
It's crazy that people zero in on what they zero in on, but I should have known.
I don't find that crazy at all.
I know. I should have totally.
What are you, new here? Come on.
Yeah, I know. I must be. So I had put this line in the book. It's like no more than a paragraph about Joe Biden's obsession with his wife, which is real.
That's perfect social media content, by the way.
exactly. He has told aides that the secret to a good marriage is good sex. And people picked that up and ran with it all over the internet. But another thing that's interesting is people I didn't talk to for the book who have worked for the Bidens reached out to me. And one person told me, like, he's been saying this since the VP. Like, he just, like, says this to people. It's a point of advice gives to youngins, you know. He's imparting advice. And look, it's not bad advice. It's real. That's a important part of a relationship. So, but anyway, going back to,
point. When you're talking, we didn't talk about the Fords, but when you're talking about the Fords, it's kind of funny that, Betty Ford's big faux pas was to say that she and Gerry Ford slept in the same bed, which in the 70s was somehow scandalous. And of course, you point out the famous Kitty Kelly interview, which I assume is like mostly true from the 70s, where Joe Biden is being pretty blunt about his personal life. All right, go ahead.
It predates the VP office. I mean, he's been open about this for quite some time. I mean, I think Maureen Dowd called it, like, he's into sensuality, which is something that I would not say in my book, but something a columnist could say.
Your reporting took you into very sensitive places. But all right.
It did. So go ahead. I mean, because the book is also about marriage, you know, it's about these women, but like, it's also about the president. Like, the context is the presidency. So as much as anything else,
you can't avoid these very personal issues.
Yeah. And I mean, it's intimacy with the leader of the free world. And by intimacy, I mean holding their thoughts in confidence, holding their grudges for them. So it is sort of a sensitive topic because of how close they are. It's an isolating life. It's a singular privileged life, but it's hard to report on for that reason, too.
Yeah. All right. So I've derailed things a little bit, but...
Yeah. That's all to say, that interlude is all to set up this idea that he really loves his wife and it can sometimes veer into overprotectiveness. He doesn't like her to be gone for more than a few days at a time. He's always happier when she's there, as his aides will attest. He's much more demanding, frustrated, quick to anger when she's away. And the context of these conversations about whether she would teach or not is him saying, baby, like literally baby. She does not like that nickname, saying, we don't know how you're going to do this, if it's going to be too much, how are you going to take a salary? Some of the concerns were about whether she would violate the emoluments clause, working for a state-funded school after 4 years of Trump sort of breaking the rules with that specific clause. So there was all this, you know, if you know anything about the Biden circle, which you do, they obsess over, you know, everything and sometimes the little things. So she had to sort of nod along and not react in this meeting I reported on, but then behind the scenes works with one of her senior aides to clear a path with the school. She says, I'm going to teach. I'm going to sign up for the Zoom teaching. And then she kind of springs it on Biden and everybody during the transition when they're preparing for an interview for Stephen Colbert. And basically, one of the prep questions is, are you going to teach? And she's like, yep. And Biden interjects and is like, yeah, but only a few hours, right? And she's like, no, 15 credits, full course load. I didn't know this. Yeah, I told you this. And then it was settled. It was just, she set it up.
But he didn't know. So what was so amazing about that story is, and it's reported out so nicely in the book, is they're doing this in front of staff. And he's sort of surprised by her decision, which is a pretty important decision.
And it's been recounted to me as like kind of an awkward moment, right? Because these people,
mommy and daddy are fighting.
And you're getting this moment, you're getting this look into a marriage that everybody understands is solid and there's a lot of love there. But like these two have been around a long time. They know not to have conversations like this around anyone. You know, they have what did Jill Biden say? They fexed, like fight text, when they know other people are around. I mean, the fact that this sort of played out in the open was interesting, and it's interesting strategy on the First Lady's part for not only am I going to do this on a call with my husband, but it's so everyone who is closest to us knows that this is what I'm doing, and there will be, and I'm going to say this on television if it gets asked. So it shows you how she kind of has navigated. Not that I think, you know, she would say that in the end there were no doubts from him. Like he's obviously supportive of her, but that's how she navigates some of these trickier, almost bureaucratically Biden scenarios.
Yeah. What was the term? Effects? That was a Jill or a Joe thing?
Jill called it fexting with an F.
That's good. Wow. I've never heard of that, but I've definitely gotten some fexts in my time.
Yeah, I mean, haven't we all? So, I mean, but they do that in part because they know not to like fight in front of their aides and or Secret Service agents. Like they, you know, so it's an interesting term.
What's the genesis of this project?
Okay, so let's go back to 2021, mid COVID, no vaccines, everyone's locked down. I have a newborn, and my agent asked me if I had any interest in writing a Jill Biden biography. I covered, you know, the Trump White House and Melania Trump, and as well as President Trump, but I just had a special interest, I think, in the East Wing. And so I think that's why he thought of me. But I didn't want to do it. I mean, I had been asked to do Melania books too, and a Jill book. I thought I didn't know much about her. I didn't really know if there would be enough to fill a book on her tenure. I just didn't know. I had just come off of covering Trump, so I wasn't sure. So I said no, but I said I like positioning her, in a lineup of women who've had this role, just covering Melania, being cognizant of Michelle Obama, even though I didn't cover her, coming of age, you know, during the Clinton and Bush administrations, I noticed how much interest was in the First Lady role culturally. So I kind of just wanted to do something that had a specific point of view about how the role has evolved along with our changes in politics, in technology, in pop culture. And what I found was, you know, the role really hasn't changed as much as the rest of us like to think we have, and in terms of just the way we perceive women in public life. So that's kind of how it started, with a broad biography pitch. And then I kind of took the opportunity to do something that I wanted to read or see in the world, I guess.
How did researching and writing this book while covering the White House, and I don't know if it coincided exactly with writing this book, but having a new family and a new daughter, how did that influence your views of how these women that you're writing about balanced their public and private roles, which is, you know, so much a part of the book? And it just struck me that, you know, in knowing you and your husband and your daughter, struck me you were doing the same thing as you were writing this.
Yeah. I think it's funny because I have thought about this fleetingly. Nobody's ever really asked me about it. I guess maybe I thought it's obvious, but becoming a mom in this business, is it changes your view on a lot of stuff. But then I had a 5-month-old when I decided to write a book about first ladies. So it just changed how I encountered them in my reporting and my research. And I understood their boundaries in a different way, in a way that I could not have possibly understood it before. I guess Michelle Obama is maybe the prime example of this, where she stepped back from a high-powered career to make sure her husband had the best shot he could at winning the presidency. But more than that, she didn't really put a policy plan in place until her two daughters were well-adjusted in Washington. And she knew herself well enough to set those boundaries and set those expectations right from the beginning. She had given up so much of her identity already. And just the fact that she preserved that piece of it for her family, I think there were people at the time who had opinions over whether or not she should have given up her job, or whether or not she should have launched, you know, Let's Move in the first 6 months, or been more of a activist or policy-making first lady. The fact that she stuck to her boundaries in service of her daughters, I just looked at that a lot differently, I think, than I would have before.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. That's really interesting. And I'm sure it wasn't easy to be covering the White House and raising a young girl. And I'm sure Lily and John are very proud of the book. And Lily's probably a little too early for her to read it.
She's paging through it. But
thank you for doing this.
Thank you. She's paging through it.
Well, there are pictures. She's got the pictures. And then thank you for doing it. I hope people read and buy American Woman by Katie Rogers. And then Katie, you know, we have this little, this new thing we do on this show where I'm going to ask you the last question is by our last guest, who in the incestuous nature of our profession happens to be your colleague at the New York Times, Carlos Lozada, who also has a book out. And Carlos's question for you, although he didn't know you were going to be the next guest, is, if you weren't doing this Washington thing that you're doing, what would you do?
Oh my gosh. I mean, look, Washington was an accident for me. I got shipped down here the week of Trump's inauguration for a 3-month tour. I thought I was going to return to New York and write features. So I don't know. I'd probably be pursuing a very different type of journalism than the kind I'm doing now, but this has been totally enriching. It's, you know, has been the best story that, you know, I've ever covered. I mean, the act of Washington, the act of the presidency, the act of politics in this time. It's hard to imagine doing anything else, but I don't know. I'd probably be writing celebrity profiles or something.
Thank you. All right. And now you've got to leave us with a question for the next guest on Deep Dive. who obviously you don't know who it's going to be.
I know. So Carlos's question was about Washington. Yeah, let me think. How do you define success? Well, how do you see? Well, I want to ask, how do you succeed in Washington? But I also want your next guest to talk about how they define success for themselves. Like, I would be interested in like how Axelrod would have answered that. Or
yeah,
what does success look like in your profession? And what does success look like to you?
Perfect. I love it. Thank you for playing along with that.
Sure.
That's a good one. Thanks for doing this. This was great. Really enjoyed it.
You're welcome.
And that's our show. Our producer is Kara Tabor. Our senior producer is Alex Keeney. Thank you to Peter Cosmall for field production in South Bend, Indiana. I'm Ryan Lizza, host and executive producer of Deep Dive. Our music is by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Tell us what you think about the show or who you'd like to hear on Deep Dive. You can email me at rlizza@politico.com. And please subscribe to Playbook Deep Dive wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.